Welcome to That's What She Said, a podcast of sermons preached at Galileo Christian Church, Disciples of Christ, near Fort Worth, Texas. I'm Remy Owens. My pronouns are they, them, and theirs, and I'm the director of this podcast. Galileo Church exists to seek and shelter spiritual refugees, who for us are people for whom the church has become boring, irrelevant, exclusive, or even painful, especially people who've been pushed out because of their gender or sexuality. If you yourself are a spiritual refugee, we're especially glad you're listening.
My name is Heather, and my pronouns are them, theirs, and us. And I'm going to lead you in the responsive reading from 1 Corinthians 13. The part that is in the black part is all of us, including myself, just as a reminder. So here we go. If I speak in the tongues of mortals and of angels, but do not love, I am a noisy gong or a clanging cymbal. Love bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. And if I have prophetic powers and understand all mysteries and all knowledge, and if I have all faith so as to remove mountains, but do not have love, I am nothing. Love bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. If I give away all my possessions, and if I hand over my body so that I may boast, but do not have love, I am nothing. Love bears all things, believes all things, hopes in all things, endures all things. Love is patient, love is kind. Love is patient, love is kind. Love is not envious or boastful or arrogant or rude. Love is not envious or boastful or arrogant or rude. Love does not insist on its own way. It is not irritable or resentful. It does not rejoice in wrongdoing, but rejoices in the truth. Love bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. Love never ends. But as for prophecies, oh, they will come to an end. And as for tongues, they will cease. And as for knowledge, it will come to an end. For we know only in part, and we prophesy only in part. But when the complete comes, the partial will come to an end. When I was a child, I spoke like a child. I thought like a child. I reasoned like a child. When I became an adult, I put an end to childish ways. For now we see in a mirror dimly, but then we will see face to face. Now I know only in part, then I will know fully, even as I have been fully known. Love bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. And now faith, hope, and love abide. These three, and the greatest of these is love. Love bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. Love never ends.
Roses are red, violets are blue. I'd rather do funerals than weddings, and most clergy would too. Now you know why I write prose, not poetry. And if I've done your wedding, that is to say, if I officiated over the vows of holy matrimony that you took with your beloved, please know that yours was the best wedding ever. And it brought me great joy. I would do it all again. I'm speaking only generally here of the big categories, weddings and funerals, two occasions that most clergy get to know intimately over the course of their ministries. Generally speaking, 9.5 out of 10 clergy surveyed say they prefer funerals over weddings. Do not tweet that. I just made that up. But I bet it's pretty close. Here's why. Because funerals are more real. because death is an undeniable fact on the ground. And while the friends and family of the deceased may try to pretend that the dead person was a kinder, funnier, more reliable, less selfish person than they actually were, no one will try to pretend they didn't die. No one will try to pretend that death does not suck, and that we are all not wishing for more life all the time. Funerals are true. Weddings, on the other hand, often are not. I will pause here to note an exception in my experiences of the weddings of LGBT and Q couples I have officiated. Queer couples have very often slogged through a lot of relational and religious shit to get to the point of wanting to make promises to each other in front of God and everybody. Promises to take care of each other forever. Promises to be each other's person until the first funeral separates them in this life. Queer couples, in my experience, tend to be ridiculously realistic about the high costs of relationship. Those weddings are pretty damn true. But I worry that as LGBTQ marriages become common, they might become infected by the same silliness that straight weddings have embraced. Like, at some point when it's no longer a big deal that you're getting married at all, you start to imagine ways to make your wedding special. To wit, you buy a bridesmaid's dress tailored especially for your bulldog. Not a support animal, just a dog, don't at me. And then become indignant when the church won't allow the dog in the sanctuary for the ceremony. Or you spend weeks coordinating a dance routine for getting all your matching pairs of best friends down the aisle, but resent the pastor's requirement that you participate in premarital counseling to prepare for the actual rest of your lives, because who's got time for that when you're planning a wedding? Or you write your own vows in poetry every bit as bad as mine, promising things like, I'll never ask you for a good morning kiss before you've had your coffee. Because the traditional promises to weather sickness and health, poverty and wealth, the serendipitous better and the catastrophic worse are too generic, not specialized enough for the specialness of you and your beloved. Okay, yeah, for today, I am both of those grumpy old white men Muppets heckling from the balcony. I will own it. Get off my lawn. There is a reason for my Statler and Waldorf mood, though, and here it is. It's 1 Corinthians 13. One of the best known passages in the Bible because of all the damn weddings it's been in. And because of all the weddings it's been in, it's grossly misunderstood, meaning that we have inherited a sappy, sentimental version of love that hurts rather than helps us in real relationship, no bullshit ever. When the Apostle Paul, who was the original grumpy old man among our ancestors in faith, wrote his first letter back to the Corinthian Christians, he was, in the tradition of parents everywhere in every time, both worried sick about them and extremely pissed at them. Parents, we need a word for that feeling, worried and pissed in equal measure. Purried? Whist? You can work it out. Whatever we call it, though, that's what Paul was, because he was their parent in faith. He was the one who told the Corinthians about Jesus in the first place. He told them about God's longing to have humanity's heart, God's pining for us, God's yearning for us, God doing everything God could think of to get us back, God finally making the ultimate sacrifice, even unto death on a cross, even unto rejection by religious authorities and state execution as a criminal, all to express that love and win our hearts. And this is what love looks like, Paul had told the Corinthians when he told them the stories about Jesus, about how he asked his friends and enemies alike to remember him whenever they ate and drank together. And Paul told them, too, that all who experienced the love of God, all who pledged themselves to follow in the footsteps of this Jesus, this Christ, would themselves become loving people, considering the needs of others before their own, forming relationships that felt like family, because baptismal water is thicker than blood. And those relationships all together, he said, would be called church. Now, he said all that, and then he had to run, because Paul was always running, propelled in equal measure by the rock-throwing haters who were chasing him out of town, and the compelling thought of all the people down the road who had not yet heard the good news that God's love is the realest thing in the world. We know that he stayed in Corinth longer than he stayed anywhere else, but it was still not long enough, because by the time he was writing back his very first letter, the Corinthian Christians were already fighting with each other. They fought over all kinds of stuff in Corinth. I don't want to get into specifics tonight, but perhaps you would not be surprised to know that they fought over status, like who had been around longer and therefore had more of a say in their young church. And they fought over dietary restrictions that made the sharing of meals complicated. And they fought over whose turn it was to stand up in front of the church and talk. And they fought over morality and ethics, about how to make Christian decisions concerning sex and money and work and clothing. Yeah, clothing. For 2,000 years, we've been judging each other's clothing in the name of Jesus. I've done it. I've tweeted in judgy frustration from DFW Airport that leggings are not pants. Paul might have tweeted back, if he could, that I had sort of missed the point. The point being, of course, that God's love is the realest thing in the world, the engine that powers the universe, and that as one of the people in the world who knows that, believes that, trusts that, I'm supposed to be doing that, pouring my love like fuel into the engine that powers the universe, contributing love to the universe rather than judgy tweets about other people's fashion choices. And then at some point in this lengthy letter called 1 Corinthians, I think Paul realizes that if he just keeps going like that, case by case, rebuking every unloving tweet, considering every conflict that the Corinthians have gotten themselves into, this letter is just going to go on. It's never going to end. And so he crescendos to a big peak in chapter 13, saying, in effect, what is it you don't yet understand about this life you've been called to live? What is it you don't yet understand about love? Let me try to spell it out for you. It won't be like a recipe or an instruction manual or a legal code. It'll be more like a poem with a rhythm that you can slow dance to. It'll sound like a song you once heard on the car radio late at night with your head on your lover's shoulder. It'll sound so sweet, you want to have your cute little cousin read it at your wedding. But listen, this is not romance, he would say. This is real life. This love is not smooth. It is gritty, and it is true, and it is hard. And it's not for your wedding. It's for your church. And if we could hear it that way, church, like it's for us, like it's for the relationships we're in here, well, that'd really be something. Being patient and kind, not arrogant or rude, letting others have their way, rejoicing in truth-telling, enduring, hoping, believing in each other, those would be our star map, our little dipper with Polaris, the North Star at the end of the handle, showing us the way home, showing us the way to God's heart through these real relationships, no bullshit, ever. Now, Besides being a contentious church full of people who assertively pursue their own best interest through the church's life, which the Corinthian church seems to have been, and which I mostly think Galileo church is not, I can still see a couple ways our own little dipper might get scrambled up and end up pointing us in the wrong direction. One is, if we carry forward into this place our inherited idea of church, where the gathered body of believers is just a loose collection of folks who have little to do with each other, actually, that church doesn't fight very much because those people don't do very much life together. It's church with a kind of live and let live ethic, the highest ideal being that everybody minds their own business. I'm going to be honest with you. A lot of spiritual refugees I know got smacked down in conserving churches because those churches were mean and judgmental, holding everybody accountable to a standard of righteousness that they both invented and enforced. And as a result, some of those spiritual refugees are now terrified of and resistant to any involvement in church beyond showing up on their own terms. But this is a hard word. Bear with me here if you love me. Being part of a liberating church does not mean being free of responsibility in relationship. It does not mean doing whatever you want, the church having nothing to say about it. If we say we do real relationship, no bullshit ever, it means in the first place that we are in relationship. And Christian relationships are governed by love, and love is the thing that Paul describes in 1 Corinthians 13, this thing that is so intense that some people want it read on their wedding day. And that's the second way our little dipper gets all scrambled up, closely related to the first. The words of 1 Corinthians 13 suffer from that recontextualization in weddings. At first, we imagine that these words about love are so intense they could only be meant for a pair of star-crossed lovers. And then we insert them into ceremonies that celebrate the summit of sentimentality with the dresses and the unity candles or the sand art thingies and the romantic pop ballads, thereby cheapening their meaning, making it impossible to feel their weight. Because, I mean, who wants to imagine on their wedding day that some significant part of committing to love another person includes endurance, pure and simple? That some percentage of staying married involves waiting out the awful parts and preparing for even awfuler parts? Like, what of the reality that for several years of my kids' infancy and early childhoods, no vomit was spilled in our home except that it landed on me? So that more times than I'd like to count, the baby and I would strip in the shower, handing puke-covered clothing out to my spouse and pushing chunks of whatever it was down the drain with my toes. What of the reality that a friend of ours described for us in the days before his spouse died of how much he was learning about love by washing his beloved's body in the shower each day, and of how much easier it was if he just undressed too and got in, because then he could embrace his spouse, bathe his spouse, without the hesitation of spoiling his own clothes. What of that in the wedding recitations of Paul's poetry? What of that in the church Paul wrote to, admonishing them to stop bickering and love each other, to participate in the love God has demonstrated to us by the giving of God's own body? God and us too, bearing all things, believing all things, hoping all things, enduring all things. This is love. What if the church the world needs most right now is the church that is a school for love? What if when someone asked you, "What about your church?" it felt true to say, "Our church is a classroom where we are learning love, where our curriculum is kindness and patience, where we are working on not insisting on our own way, where we are practicing not being irritable or resentful." What if when we gather here at the Big Red Barn or in somebody's living room or on any random afternoon to share a drink in the heat of the day, we are a study group discerning between wrongdoing and truth-telling, celebrating one and not the other, learning how to love more, how to love better? I have a pastor, a colleague, somebody I aspire to be like, shout out to Anthony Smith over in North Carolina, who says whenever his church gathers that he's going to the lab. Like his church is a lab, a learning lab, a place to figure stuff out, a time to experiment and test theories and get better at what we're meant to do and be for the world God still loves. The church as a learning lab for love, bearing all things, believing all things, hoping all things, enduring all things. The church as a learning lab for real relationship, no bullshit ever. What if that's what we're doing here? Because listen, church, if we're not doing it here, then who's doing it where? If not us, who? If not here, where? I am not being sentimental about this church, I promise. I will admit to wearing rose-colored romance glasses when it comes to Galileo much of the time, but I also pay careful attention when people tell me it feels a little cliquish in here, that not everybody feels cozy and cared for just because they walk through that door, that there are streaks of meanness that run through the church, yes, even this church, because we are, after all, human beings and not quite as good at it as Jesus was. But what if that's kind of the point, too? That we learn to love in circumstances that are less than ideal, among people who are less than perfect, but where at least we have agreed that love is the lesson. So that having learned it in here, we can go out there and apply what we know. So that the love quotient in the world out there goes up as we learn how in here. So that God's love becomes more and more real because we are manifesting it in our kindness and patience, in our humility and contentedness, in our bearing and believing and hoping and enduring all things. What if God, who so loved the world that God gave the world God's own child, now so loves the world that God gives the world God's own church? And what if the song we're about to sing is our love song to the world God still loves? Let's try it.
Thanks for listening to That's What She Said. This podcast is edited and produced by Nathan Berry and preached almost always by Reverend Dr. Katie Hayes. Galileo Church has four missional priorities. We do justice for LGBTQ+ people. We do kindness to those in mental and emotional distress and celebrate neurodiversity. We do beauty for our God who is beautiful. And we do real relationship, no bullshit ever. To support the ongoing production of this podcast and the missional priorities of Galileo Church, go to galileochurch.org and click on Conspire with Us. You'll have options to use your Venmo or PayPal, or use your credit card or bank account. Any amount helps, and if you're kind enough to share your contact information with us, we will continually send you thanks. Peace.